Hello and welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Alpha podcast. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by someone who likes to create a bit of alpha himself, our private investor diarist, John Rosier. How are you doing, John?
Very well, thanks, John. Great to be on.
Excellent, always good to have you. So we're kind of between issues for your updates, but we thought it might be a good time to get a bit of a third quarter update, which is what we're seeing a lot of across the RNS at the moment. How's the year gone so far, John?
This year, it's been a case, I think. A lot of people say two steps forward, one step back, but it's much harder than that, like one and a half steps forward and then one step back. But the bottom line is, as of last night, my portfolio that I publish in the Investors Chronicle every month is up 4% this year, exactly 4.0%. That compares with a 23% drop in the all-share total return and a 3% rise in the FTSE All-World Index. That's the Sterling Index total return. So, not a bad return. From the 23rd of March bottom, the portfolio is up 54%. That compares with 18% for the all-share and 30% for the all-world. So it's bounced back well. But I have made some mistakes.
Yeah, Phil and I spoke about some mistakes on last week's Alpha podcast, and I think you've made a similar one that he did. Games Workshop, yes. That's one of them.
Yes, that is. So the three were, I sold Scottish Mortgage and compounded it by not buying back in. So that's cost a bit. Games Workshop, I sold. I actually added at the lower level, but it recovered strongly and I guess it was valuation got to me, but maybe I'm learning a lesson there. I was talking to someone the other day and they said, never sell because of valuation. Only sell if the story's changed rather than valuation.
I think that was the conclusion Phil came to last week in respect of Games Workshop. He is very much a fundamentals guy and valuation has always been very important to him. But I think he's reached that point where he sees that valuation is not the be all and end all. Some of these fast growth stocks.
Yeah. On the other hand, one has to stick to one's approach. And, I sort of say in my investing approach on my website that, I favour stocks that are somewhere around 14 to 20 times that sort of PE ratio with a PEG ratio that's sort of less than one. So you've got some scope for the sort of re-rating of things. Mm. So I sold Games Workshop and I shouldn't have. So maybe that's the thing. Maybe be disciplined on when you get into a stock in terms of your valuation, because that gives you a lot of upside, hopefully, from a revaluation. But then maybe let them run and not let the valuation lead you to sell the stock.
What was your thinking behind selling Scottish Mortgage?
I think at the time, let's be honest, I didn't think that you would see the amazing recovery that you saw in technology stocks in the US. Because, I sold the Scottish Mortgage, fairly early on in the drop. I'm just looking here. Yeah, I sold it fairly early on in the drop. So as I say, the big mistake was not realizing what was happening and buying back into it, where I had that ample opportunity to do so. Yeah, I sold it here. I'm having a look here. Yeah, I sold it. Gosh, this looks awful looking at the chart. I sold it at £6.20 on the 7th of February. So I was out of it then. And it dropped to 4.50. So that looked pretty good, pretty clever. not doesn't look so clever now when it's £10.
Yeah, there was a whole Tesla factor in the Scottish Mortgage recovery. And I don't think anyone could have predicted what's gone on there. That stock, that company went ballistic. The shares absolutely rocketed, and it's a big chunk of Scottish Mortgage. I can understand why you might have been nervous looking at Tesla and what was going on there before the recovery and the share price.
I remember talking to, an investment club a few years back, and they told me something about when they cut a stock, they then always made a note And if the share price ever rose back to the level at which they cut it, they then reviewed it again. So maybe that's quite a good discipline to put in. But having said that, you know, would I have, when it recovered back to £6 odd, have gone back in? Maybe I'd have been scared by Tesla's valuation, etc. I don't know. But maybe that would be a good discipline.
Yeah, I mean, but you do run your risk and reward system that you introduced into the magazine some months ago now. I mean, you know, yeah. In the case of Scottish Mortgage and Gains Workshop, I mean, how were you influenced by that system? Did the system work there? I mean, you know, was the system guiding you in a sort of mechanical way when perhaps a mechanical approach wasn't what you needed at the point where you sold?
Yeah, I think it would have because with Gains Workshop, basically because of the valuation, I'd have lowered my sort of reward rating on it, and would have been, because I would have thought that, you know, the potential reward from it had been reduced because the valuation was in my mind then stretched. So mechanically that forced me to reduce the exposure to it. Yeah, maybe there's a case for, you know, again, having a sort of minimum. I mean, I think the problem with that, with Games Workshop, is maybe not selling some shares and reducing the position. You know, maybe the problem is that I've just sold out completely out of what, you know, is a high quality, high return on capital stock.
It's a funny one, though, isn't it? Because they say, you know, you can never make a loss by taking a profit, but equally they also say run your winners. So you're kind of caught between two stools there.
Although it's a funny one, though, because, I mean, one can get very hung up on individual stocks. And I always say at the end of the day that, you know, the most important thing is how does the whole portfolio perform? How well do you do? And I guess if you stick to your disciplined approach, et cetera, then, which hopefully works over time, then those returns will come through. I guess it's a bit like a sports team in a way. You know, you want the whole team to win, but you don't always just focus on one player. And let's say you drop a player, but the portfolio still performs, then that's fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you know, you focus on the mistakes, but then, I mean, something like, you know, I mean, pointing to something that's good. You know, I bought into Venture Life Group back in May. I've actually bought it on 5 different occasions now. But I'm, you know, I'm up a good 30-odd% on that, and to me, it still looks an attractive stock.
Yeah,
it's one of my largest holdings.
Yeah, I mean, when we were preparing for this, you brought the mistakes up, and obviously, I don't want to focus on your mistakes, John. But do you think it's, you know, perhaps that's a better way to think about how you run a portfolio? It's like, here's where I messed up, rather than, oh, I did really well here. Are you naturally thinking about where you've gone wrong rather than sort of congratulating yourself for getting things right?
I'm only thinking about where I've gone wrong to try and learn some lessons from it. I mean, so, you know, that's why it's important. You think, right, why did I sell that then? And are there any lessons to be, you know, learnt from that? Mm. And if there are, then that's great, because hopefully it'll make you a better investor and you can make new mistakes in the future.
There's a valuable lesson in that in itself. Before we move on to the good stuff, and there is lots of good stuff in your portfolio and investment approach, there was one more mistake that you mentioned. And I think you were unlucky here, Rockrose Energy.
Yes, I mean, I guess the timing's unlucky. But, I mean, Rockrose Energy, I sold in April. And a few weeks later, there was a bid for it at a nice hefty premium. So that cost, I've just checked it up. So that cost the portfolio about £23,000. So that was just over 4% of the value of the portfolio. So when I say the portfolio is up 4% this year, I mean, all things being equal, it would have been up around 8% had I not made that decision. But again, there you go. You make the decisions for a reason.
It's bad luck, and you've got a bit of hindsight in there as well, which you obviously couldn't predict at the time. I mean, talking of predictions, something else we talked about before we started recording was the business of predictions, which is something you said you didn't really like. But we have to look to the future. I mean, how do you sort of go about wondering where things are going to go, but also try not to predict where things are going to go?
Well, I guess the thing is, you know, at the end of the day, I try and focus on picking stocks where I think, you know, I'd be happy holding it sort of in any circumstances. Would I be happy holding this stock in a year's time or 3 years' time? And so I think that's an important starting point. Because if you're just buying a stock because you think a certain thing will happen in the market and that certain thing doesn't happen, then you're left high and dry. So I think the starting point is making sure you're really happy with those stocks and would you hold them for the long term. And this sort of gets you onto this, you know, big debate at the moment between, you know, value and growth, and should we be buying more value, which has underperformed so badly. And I think there is a case for buying value or recovery stocks. But I think you've got to be really certain of which ones you buy. Because, you know, if the economy doesn't recover how you think it might, then you've got to be certain that the stock doesn't disappear altogether, go bust.
Yeah, absolutely. But you said you were feeling more bullish, and you know, given what given what we see going on around us, you know, there is a rather sort of bitter U.S. election being fought, the outcome of which is very uncertain and could prove horrendous for markets either way. The COVID crisis doesn't look like it's going away. If anything, it looks like it's worsening. Where's your bullishness coming from?
Right. Well, I mean, well, first of all, I do try and take. A sort of medium-term view anyway. So I'm always sort of, you know, whenever I'm looking at the stocks and my reward sort of rating on the stock, I'm trying to look out over the next 12 months. How do I think this stock, or what potential does this stock have over the next 12 months? So, you know, who knows what will happen next Tuesday? One hopes for a clear-cut result one way or the other, I guess, rather than, you know, uncertainty. But, you know, after that, I mean, I think whatever happens, you get to January, there'll be a new president will be inaugurated, or Donald Trump will start a second term. But, you know, that sort of uncertainty will be gone. Hopefully there'll be a Brexit agreement. Again, you know, people might think I'm optimistic to think there will be, but, you know, I think the way these things go, it's in everyone's interest. And I think, you know, it might go down to the wire, but I think there will be an agreement. So, again, maybe I'm being hopelessly optimistic. But I think looking out to next year, at some stage, this dreadful COVID will be sort of behind us, or at least it won't be so important in our everyday lives, either because of herd immunity or because of vaccinations or whatever. But you could then see, you know, I think as you pointed out in your editorial in today's edition, you know, a complete change in the way that people behave, which at the moment seems a bit odd to us. And I saw in, John Authors, former colleague of yours at the FT, he does a daily email. And a few weeks ago, he put a chart out from Longview Economics. And it basically highlighted how much household savings have grown, you know, during this pandemic. But we all know the savings ratio shot up. But that Longview have actually put it in terms of billions of pounds. And basically, it goes back to 1992 and up until the beginning of this year, it bounced around between 20 and 40 billion in total. And then basically from February, March this year, it's just shot up. And the figure's now 110 billion. So there's 110 billion of household savings there, which I think when confidence returns, will get spent. And I guess it's working out where it will get spent.
Yeah.
And holidays. I'd have thought holidays. I should think a lot of people have missed out on a nice overseas holiday this year. Maybe cars, maybe electric cars, maybe just shopping, you know, clothes, etc. So there could be quite a boom in sort of consumer spending at some stage next year. Don't know when. Second quarter, third quarter.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're right. So the point of my editorial is, you know, we often hear that COVID has brought about permanent changes to the way we work, shop, you know, eat, you know, pretty much every aspect of our lives is going to change permanently. And my view is that that's perhaps been overstated. That actually, we are where we are now, but people would like just, you know, the new normal might be people wanting to get back to the old normal, going out, going shopping, as you say. So I can see that value argument. But isn't it the timing thing that's the problem? Because people have been calling the rebirth of value for some time.
Yes. Well, and also, I mean, there was a fascinating talk given by Terry Smith a month ago, which got some publicity. And, he's a fund smith and obviously a growth investor or certainly, you know, more of a quality investor. I mean, obviously, he picked his stocks for this, but he looked at a basket of five stocks in 2015, things like Exxon, General Electric, HSBC, M&S and Vodafone. They all had trailing PEs in the mid-teens, except Vodafone actually was only on five times, but the others were on around 12, 15 times. He then looked at a growth basket of trailing PEs of Adobe on 136, Amazon on minus 593, Facebook 71, Netflix 554, PayPal 88. And he said, you know, which would you have thought in 2015 might have done better or would have been a safer bet given those valuations? And the point is, 5 years later, that value basket is down 45% and the growth basket is up 800%.
Yeah, that value basket sounds like a few companies that have had issues that have been around for a long, long time, though. Big tankers to turn around.
I think he selected wisely. But then again, you know, you look at some of those PEs on those growth stocks. And I certainly wasn't buying any of those. 4 or 5 years ago, because I would have been completely put off by the valuation. But I do think that there could be a huge bounce back when you look at, banks, and I guess they're having a little bit of a bounce this week on slightly better figures. But you look at, retail areas like that. And, you know, some of these, get it right. I mean, Superdry is a stock I don't hold, but certainly one I'm looking at, and the share price seems to be telling you something. These recovery stocks, if they start to, you know, beat expectations, et cetera, they can get a real following. So I think one recovery stock I do own, I bought a few months back, is Billeroo.
I was just about to point that out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the sort of clear out-and-out recovery stock in my portfolio, in that, you know, the valuation looks pretty cheap, moving out into next year. It needs, they've had their rights issue to shore up the balance sheet. The management seem to be doing the right thing in terms of sort of expectation management and also in terms of running the business, in terms of cutting costs, focusing on the good growth areas within the business. But I think we've got interims next month. But we've had a trading update, so maybe I shouldn't expect too much from that.
Wasn't a good performer for you last month, was it? I think you mentioned it as one of the poor performers, down 10%. So, I mean, these things can be a bumpy ride.
Yes, I think it will be at this stage because, until the recovery's proven or people really buy into it, then, it'll tend to trade sideways within a sort of, I don't know, 30p sort of, which 20% for this stock, sort of from the 160s down to the sort of 130 level. But then what you tend to get, hopefully, is a sort of step change. When they come out with results that one would hope would then lead to earnings upgrades because the recovery is shown to be sort of ahead of expectations. Then you'd hope to see a step change up to a new sort of trading range.
I guess this is like one of those companies that people have written off because COVID has changed the world. You know, this is the death of cash victim, isn't it, De La Rue? And I guess then you've got that bumpy ride. So you've got two sort of cognitive hurdles to overcome here: overcoming that narrative in the first place that this is a company in the wrong place, and then hanging on when it bounces around. What do you do to stay disciplined there?
Well, that's true. And I think ultimately the only thing that can sort of change that narrative is results. Because each time they come out with better results, improved results, and also they demonstrate, you know, the new area, the areas of the business that are actually performing very well, which for them is a sort of certification business, authentication business. So, you know, physical cash or banknotes becomes less important, although, you know, it's still important. It was good to see they won an extension of their Bank of England contract this morning. But, you know, the other business, a decent high return on capital, you know, if that grows strongly, then, again, the narrative can change, I think. And also, you know, the management, you know, how they come across in terms of, you know, really getting the business moving in the right direction. Again, that's important. You know, they've got to tell the story and then basically beat expectations. That's the art of the game.
Mm. I mean, I know you do a lot of research, whatever share you're buying, but again, in the case of a company like De La Rue, it sounds like you've got to dig a bit deeper to see where that value, that shifting strategy is in the business and how successful it might be. I mean, is that the case? Do you work a bit harder on the value approach?
Yes, you do. And also, I think what you've got to be certain of is to say, when you're buying these value stocks, you know, your risk is that actually the recovery doesn't come through and then you're left exposed. So I think you've got to look at what the downside risk is. So for me, it was very important when they, you know, raised, I think it was around 100 million, which sort of shored up the balance sheet. So although it led to a little bit of dilution, you know, that gave me confidence to build up the exposures of the stock. You know, at the end of the day, it's sort of trying to look at your downside. So, you know, if something comes to next results aren't how I expect them, or the year end result, or they get hit by a loss of a big contract that we weren't expecting, etc. You know, does that mean it's the end of De La Rue? And so you've got to look at the downside, and if you're happy that basically your the balance sheet's good enough, etc., to weather some bumps along the way, then, you know, I think that's important as well.
So you mentioned you personally, your portfolio has really significantly outperformed the UK FTSE indices. So in terms of value, there is a lot out there in the UK. There are a lot of unloved companies. You mentioned Superdry, but what else have you got your eye on? What are you hunting around? Where are you hunting? What are you looking for?
I guess it's looking for those areas where you know, people have written them off. So you can look in retail, and there's plenty of names in retail. You can look in property. It's not an area I've ever really invested that much in, you know, except my house, but I live in that. But, you know, you look at things like Shaftesbury this week, it's pretty prime property, which, you know, when the tourists come flocking back to London, which they will do at some stage, I'd have thought, you know, Shaftesbury, which owns, you know, large swathes of sort of retail in the West End, Carnaby Street, etc., you'd have thought that would bounce back. So I think you've got to be quite selective. But
that's exactly the case that we made in the magazine this week in our new long tip format, which I assume you've seen. But yeah, I think you're right about property. I think property, but certainly commercial property, retail property up in London and places like that has been really written off as something that nobody wants anymore.
Yes. And also, there'll always, I mean, the thing about property, I guess, is that, you know, people say, oh, there won't be as, you know, much need for office space as there were. And maybe there won't, but, you know, there's still need for houses, etc. And you can change the use of property as well. So even if there isn't quite the demand there was, or companies decide they don't need quite as much because, you know, 20% of their workforce is at home each day because they take one day a week off or whatever, I don't know. But you know, property always has a value in terms of, even if you change the use of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And actually, the thing that always strikes me is that, you know, we talk, everyone's working from home, or lots of people are working from home at the moment, but, you know, people are talking about a sort of 2 day at home, 3 day in the office working pattern. But that to have less space, you would presumably have to hot desk, and hot desking is pretty much something that nobody wants to do right now. You know, we're definitely not being encouraged to share desks.
Yeah, no, but I mean, in the future, that might be okay. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one on that, on the working from home, etc. But I can see certainly younger people, etc., will want to get back in.
Yeah, I think so too.
One other area which I do think is important: oil, and what happens with oil. Because I mean, the simple narrative is what we're all going green, and so demand for oil is going to drop. And basically, it's never really going to recover, and you don't really want to be in these stocks. But I think there's a big opportunity in that over the next couple of years, because I think when we do return to some semblance of normality, and people do go on holiday again, and they do fly, and they're out, maybe they'll drive more than public transport, who knows. But I think... you'll see a good recovery in the oil price at some stage, and then a lot of these oil stocks will look cheap. And I mean, one of my stocks, Lundin Energy, which is Swedish listed, they had results this morning, and a note came across my desk, and I just rather liked the title of it, which was sort of, here it is: buy it, sleep well, and check status in 2022. And that's sort of my feeling with this stock. You know, it's generating a lot of cash. It's on a free cash flow yield of 17%, 23% return on invested capital, and volume, you know, it's growing its production. So I'm just sort of buying that, and I expect within a couple of years' time I'll have made a decent return on it. And in the meantime, I'm getting over 5% dividend yield.
Yeah, absolutely. You've never really been shy about having oil in the portfolio, though. It's always been good for you.
I've done quite well out of names in the past. I mean, even Rockrose, where I bailed too early, I made a decent profit out of it. But I've done all right in the past with it. I mean, Serica, I've only got two at the moment. So I've got 4.5% in Lundin, and Serica Energy, I've got 1.5% in. But, you know, they're a gas play, North Sea, and gas prices are improving, 100 million of cash on the balance sheet.
Yeah, that's
a recovery play, you know, for me.
One thing that always strikes me about your portfolio, I don't recall you talking about it that much, is the principle of asset allocation. I look at your portfolio and I see, you know, a nice spread of shares that are diversified across industries. You've got tech in there, healthcare, you've got gold miners, you've got oil companies. Do you think about that asset allocation approach when you're doing this, or are you just picking good companies and it just so happens that you end up with a lovely diversified portfolio?
I probably started it by trying to pick companies that I think are going to give me a decent return, but then I would overlay that by saying, but I don't want to have too much in one particular sector or theme. So that's the way I've come at it. So I start with the companies, et cetera, but then try and make sure that, I'm not just all in commodity stocks or all in, you know, oil stocks or whatever, or all in. So that would be the overriding thing at the end, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It's, as I say, it's not something I recall you writing about, but it sort of jumps out at me when I read the portfolio. One for a future column, John.
Yeah, there's an idea. Yeah, then the other thing that I launched at the end of June, it's quite interesting because, you know, occasionally people who are members of my sort of website, occasionally people leave. And often the reason was I don't really have time to pick stocks and, you know, all the inclination and all that. I just want to really hold funds which I can sort of feel reasonably relaxed with and look at. So I then... I converted my old JIC top 10 portfolio, which was meant to be the top 10 best ideas, which never really seemed to work that well for me. And I converted that at the end of June into just a funds portfolio. So it holds investment trusts, ETFs and other funds, with the aim of getting a very good sort of geographic and industrial mix. It's probably a bit growthy in that, you know, it's got things like Fundsmith and the Baillie Gifford Positive Change Fund, sort of areas like that. And the Wisdom Tree Cloud Computing ETF. But also, you know, I've got other things like BlackRock World Mining in there, and the Chelverton UK Equity Growth Fund. Anyway, it's got a sort of exposure. And my whole idea with this portfolio was for it to be a do-little portfolio. In other words, one where you just sort of have a look at it once a month and probably do nothing, and maybe once a year rebalance, or maybe get rid of one fund and replace it with another. So then, except in extremis, really do nothing. And so far, I mean, it's only, 4 months now, I have done nothing, absolutely nothing, not one trade. And since the 1st of July, it's up 8.3%. And the FTSE All World GBP Total Return Index up 2.3%. So it's so far doing well. But what I'm slightly worried about is in a year's time, if it's done a lot better than the JIC portfolio.
It would be a nice problem to have.
Maybe. But we'll see.
And perhaps another valuable lesson that doing nothing sometimes is the best thing to do.
Yeah, well, I am going to write on that at some stage, because I'll tell you why. Because I have my portfolio, JIC portfolio, as of the 31st of December 2019. I will reveal the results of if I've done nothing compared to doing it. And obviously, you know, I've gone through a few of the mistakes, but if I've done absolutely nothing this year, if at 1st of January I said, you know what, I think I've got a great portfolio here. It's a portfolio for all seasons. Let's say even if there was a terrible pandemic, then it would have done 4% better than so far than you know, the portfolio where I have been dabbling around.
Yeah, it just goes to show, doesn't it? Is there really a right way in all of this? I think the whole world finds their way around investing. These are all valuable lessons.
The valuable lesson is just to, not to overtrade. No. I mean, I don't think I particularly overtraded, but you've really got to think about not fear. I mean, the problem is when you're watching screens that are flashing blue and red, etc., I mean, they are designed to get you to trade.
Yeah, and it's what brokers want. It's what brokers want you to do as well, because it's where they make their money.
Yeah.
Well, lots to think about. John, it's been absolutely brilliant speaking to you again. And
thank you.
And I look forward to the column in a couple of weeks.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.